The warmth of the sun floods over your face as you finally break the tree line and emerge onto the bare meadow that makes up the peak of this hill. The grass here has sat untouched for the entire summer. It will make for great grazing for your flock of sheep, which you have carefully guided along the winding hillside up to this point. With the sheep now happily grazing, you take the time to walk to the other edge of the Golden Meadow, until you reach a commanding view of the river which cascades through the valley below. What you see here, though, shocks you to your core. Strewn out haphazardly across the valley are bodies, their armor still reflecting the sun's light back up to you. Horses without riders wander around along the river, grazing just as peacefully as your sheep. Arrows litter the ground, and a burnt-out wooden hut still spews its ash towards the sky. Further signs of movement direct you towards a small band making their way through the bodies, leaning down and collecting armor and weapons which could still be used. Whether these men represent the victors of the battle or common looters from the village nearby is a mystery. Judging by the free horses, you realize this must have represented the defeat of the invading horsemen which you had heard so much fear about during the winter. It's nice to know that these invaders were defeated. Though if they truly were so powerful, surely they would be back. Between the Seas. Last time, we charted the rise and fall of Great Moravia, a union of Slavic tribes led by the Moimerids of the Morava, which had worked ever so close towards a united identity of the edge of East Francia. Today, we return to the southern region of Carpathia, firmly within the Balkan Peninsula, to look at the solidification of two great identities of the region. Identities which would persist in one form or another long into the future, the Serbs and the Bulgarians. So far in our story, we've encountered the two groups before when discussing the near collapse of the Avars in the 7th century. They both arrived, likely as relatively small but cohesive groups of horsemen, who would overthrow or subjugate local Slavic chiefdoms and carve out a political sphere of influence. Already, though, there were major differences between the two, with the Serbians likely having already been a Slavicized group of originally Iranian origin, who would quickly disperse among the local populations, while the Bulgars would remain fully separate from their tributaries, importing their Turkic steppe lifestyle onto the plains near the Danubian Delta, where they would then begin to terrorize the Byzantine Empire, through skillful defeats of their forces which were sent to eject them from the region. Despite this, the Bulgars and their sphere of influence would remain north of the Balkan Mountains and face serious internal troubles. Chapter 1. Bulgar Imperial Expansion. By the 9th century, the Bulgar fortunes would change. They would recover and finally stabilize their realm politically through a more solid identity based in opposition to the Byzantines, and stop the looting of their land through a defeat of the Romans in battle. This would coincide only a few years later with Charlemagne and the combined Friulian and Slavic wars against the Avars. Following this, the Avars would be ejected from Upper and Lower Pannonia, and kicked to a feeble position across the Danube. It is from this collapse that we see a new group of boulders enter the picture, likely a part of the wide Turkic net which made up the Avar elite. They were led by a man known as Krum, who, from the Avar remnants in Pannonia, would win the loyalty of the Bulgar elites and become their next Khan in the first decade of the 9th century. He would then lead them north to restore order over the remaining Avar lands, likely leveraging his remaining connections with the local tribes there. This expansion would greatly expand the size of the Bulgar political order and allow them to gain influence over the whole of Transylvania and Pannonia, up to the furthest extent of Frankish conquest along the Danube or Tisza rivers. In return, the formerly Avar steppe components of the Confederation would throw their lot in with the Bulgars, serving to greatly enhance the small mounted elite which still held sway from their grassland base of Pliska. Where Khan Krum would gain the majority of his fame, though, was from a renewed bout of conflicts with the Byzantines. Starting in 807, Byzantium would begin to launch raids across the border, though internal conflicts facing the then Emperor Nikephoros would cause these conflicts to remain mere raids. The Bulgars, after the retreat of the ravaging Byzantine forces, would then launch a major counter-raid south of the Balkan Mountains, razing modern Sofia, among other towns. After another year of counter-raids, the Byzantines would prepare for a major offensive against Krum and his allies. Krum, likely still consolidating power after the recent expansion to the north, did not feel prepared to face the full imperial might of Constantinople, and so sent several envoys asking for peace, which were ignored. Emperor Nikephoros himself would launch this mission north in 811. The target would be the center of Bulgar steppe power, the fortified ring of Pliska. Krum would be forced to withdraw without heavy fighting for the city, and lead his army to the surrounding hills, while the Romans would burn all of the wooden structures of Pliska to the ground, and seize all of their belongings. Importantly, the loot would reportedly not be shared with the men, as was customary, but greedily hoarded for the central treasury, according to critical sources of the time. The Byzantine mission was not over, though, as they felt a need to neutralize the Bulgar army as well. It was at this time that forces would coalesce to dissolve the massive Byzantine army. The Emperor Nikephoros would reportedly become unresponsive and static, hoping to wait the Bulgars out from their mountain retreat. His troops would accordingly lose discipline and take it upon themselves to claim their share of the loot by launching independent raids against surrounded villages without any orders. Communication was slow and inefficient among their camp, and the lack of conflicts allowed for a sense of complacency to settle in. It was precisely at the height of this dissolution that Krum would lead his Bulgars and their Slavic allies down from the mountains to attack the Byzantine camp in a surprise push. The dispersed tents, originally placed to avoid the effects of a surprise attack, did not serve their purpose after the breaking down of communications and discipline, and so the Bulgars would easily defeat the Byzantine army in piecemeal. Emperor Nikephoros himself would be taken by surprise in his tent and killed at the hands of the Bulgars. His fate would mirror that of the army, who would shatter and dissolve totally. Following the battle, Khan Krum would humiliatingly carry the emperor's head back to the burnt-out capital of Pliska, where it would be cleaned and then turned into his personal silver drinking goblet, forever serving to glorify the Khan at the expense of the Roman prestige. With this, the tides would turn, and the Khan would launch increasingly devastating raids against Byzantium. With siege tactics imported from the Avars, and perhaps Greek engineers, city after city would fall, including the Thracian stronghold of Adrianople, which had its walls destroyed. Even Constantinople itself would be a target for Krum, though he would die before he could see through a successful siege. These first few decades of the 9th century would be a time of immense change for the Bulgars, and usher them in as a truly great power of inner Europe. Besides the massive expansion of their influence, the internal dynamic would also change. As a Pannonian outsider to the oligarchy of Pliska, Krum's entourage would likely serve as a counterbalance to the hegemonic Pliska horsemen. In this same vein, it is thought that several notable Slavic tribes would begin to gain a slightly increased position, with records of them being granted the first honorary drinks from Emperor Nikephoros' skull cup, and Slavic names used as dignitaries abroad. To administer this massive realm, Krum would issue a law code which has been mostly lost to time, as well as disperse the Bulgar oligarchy to set up local power bases across the Balkans, serving to create a genuine warrior aristocracy and beginning the organic process of hierarchical regionalization which had been taking place in other areas of inner Europe. The destruction of Pliska likely aided in this movement, and as a result of this gradual dispersal, the previously closed-off Bulgar aristocracy would begin to gradually integrate with the notable Slavic populations of the tribal frontiers. The successor of Krum, Omertag, would continue the Bulgar expansion. As we saw in the episode on Lower Pannonia, the Bulgars in the 820s would launch raids into the Frankish lands across the Danube after their concerns of growing Frankish influence were ignored. The Timuk Slavs near Sirmium and modern Belgrade seem to have provided an impetus when they sided with Ludovit in his revolt, and were subsequently subjugated by the Frankish reprisal. This critical area had long been a key point for access to the Balkans, and so influence in this area was perceived as vital. So, after repeated pleas were ignored, Omertag would launch a major thrust against local Frankish-sponsored Slavic tribes, and the Dukes of Friuli would be powerless to resist. Several heads of Slavic tribes across Slavonia and northern Bosnia would be replaced with the more dispersed Bulgar warrior aristocracy. This trend of securing the flanks and forcing Bulgar patronage on surrounding unaligned Slavic tribes in the frontierlands would continue, with Omertag also pushing into Macedonia during this time, seizing lands along Lake Ohrid, all the way to the frontiers north of Thessalonica. This land had been under Byzantine patronage, though it's likely they were in reality mostly unaligned Slavic tribes which the Byzantines were powerless to defend. And here we can see an interesting point to be made about the Bulgarian identity, which had been forming and solidifying ever since the 7th century invasions. The Bulgars, despite having origins in the steppe and being based out of inner Europe, had always been positioned against the Byzantine Emperor, and found their purpose in opposition to the empire as a whole. Steppe philosophy is a brutal one, based almost entirely off of might, power, and conquest. Each tribe believes themselves capable of conquering the entire world, so long as they possess the right determination, and they naturally align themselves in a hierarchy based off of which tribe seems closest to actually achieving this goal. This, in an interesting way, aligns somewhat with the Byzantine philosophy of universal empire. Like the steppe philosophy, the Byzantines saw themselves as rightful leaders of the one universal empire, unbounded in scope, and of which all were subjects, in one form or another. Through their centralized bureaucracy, they also possessed the power to back up their claims, with large forces of disciplined soldiers, and countless elaborate ceremonies and rituals to back up their prestigious majesty. Through this, they would draw the Bulgars in like moths to a flame. The Bulgars would simultaneously be drawn into the Byzantine imperial worldview and framework, while also competing with them for leadership and might, as per the steppe motivations of their origins. By the 9th century, the Bulgarian identity would develop as essentially the second part of the same fundamental core. The Byzantines would form a universal identity which united the Christians of the Eastern Mediterranean around their maritime culture, imperial traditions, and the mercantile gravity of Constantinople, while the Bulgarians would form a universal identity which would unite the forgotten peoples of the interior Balkan hinterlands around their military might, imperial pretensions, and loot of their maritime neighbors. In this way, both would be found in the same massive orbit of Constantinople, but one representing the sea and one the land. Through this shared opposition to the central and haughty Constantinopolitans, Slavs, former Thracians and Dacians, Bulgars, and even Greeks of the interior would begin to see their place within the Bulgarian framework, something which is perhaps best seen with a look at their military organization. The Bulgars, naturally, were the appointed leaders, and they would dominate this role with an elite cavalry force. The plains around Pliska provided for long-time sustainment, recruitment, and training of these leading forces. And connections with the resources of the hinterlands and wider trade routes through the Philhellenic cities of the Black Sea would allow them to heavily armor this cavalry. With this, they would possess a terrifying central force of men, trained from birth on horseback, and armored head to toe in iron mail, but who were also familiar both with steppe tactics of trickery, ambush, and hit and run, as well as Byzantine shock tactics. They would support this core with inputs from other components of the rising Bulgarian identity, including, most notably, their Slavic allies, who would form the infantry component. These men would normally remain more lightly armored, but make up the bread and butter of siege warfare, fortifications, and static arts of battle lines, which could be used either to lure the enemy in or block strategic points such as hills, passes, or rivers. With them also came vital logistical support, knowledge of the land, and agricultural produce. From the Greeks, Avars, and Black Sea trading contacts came foreign innovations, mastery over sieges, and income to support their increasing centralization, just as had been taking place in Moravia and on the Riverlands. The wars with Byzantium had served to strengthen this final component, as the Byzantine bureaucracy had moved populations within their empire to strengthen the Bulgarian frontiers, and these populations had been subsequently captured and integrated when the Byzantine military effort collapsed under the weight of Khan Krum. Whether dispersed further into the realm or kept as frontier thematic forces, they would serve to both expand the Byzantine connection and introduce a final and vital piece of the Bulgarian formula, that being Christianity, which over the 9th century will begin to expand from the inside across all segments of the Bulgarian population. Chapter 2, Serbian Identity and Consolidation. But while the Byzantines and Bulgarians fought over which made up the more important segment of the universal imperium centered out of Constantinople, other peoples of inner Europe would remain more focused on their own land. And it is here where we will reintroduce the Serbs to the wider picture. As previously mentioned, the Serbians are thought to have first entered the Balkans, also in the 7th century, where they migrated from north of the Carpathians, from a white Serbia, potentially Sorbia in Lusatia, to settle somewhere in the hills north of Macedonia. Following this introduction to the land, little is known about the Serbs for the next couple of centuries. Though it was stated that they were introduced to Christianity at the time of their settlement, this likely did not take deep root, and they would, through their mounted power, likely spread to form a fragmented grouping of Slavic tribes possessing a loose knowledge of similar origins. Unlike the Bulgars and Byzantines, whose power was focused around the gentler lands of the lower Danubian basin in Thrace, the Slavic tribes of later Serbia and Bosnia inhabited the rough, mountainous lands of the southern and central Dinaric range. Unlike further north, near Slovenia and Croatia, the Dinaric mountains here expand to cover vast distances, which divide the land into near endless river valleys and forested hillsides. Although relatively small as a bird flies, the broken land would be elevated by its mountains to cover a truly enormous amount of territory, with communication taking just as long as the extreme distances of flatlands. Between the river valleys would be long stretches of forest or highlands, which made for excellent hunting grounds and pastures. Because of this, the populations would become rather self-sufficient and skilled in traversing large amounts of rough terrain. They would excel at learning the ins and outs of the mountains, and in mastering archery, which was used both for sustenance and for warfare. All of this would make them excellent at ambushes, which combined with fanatical defensiveness found in cultures across inner Europe, would allow the fragmented groups to maintain their independence against much stronger outsiders for several centuries. However, this rough terrain and fanatical defensiveness would also serve to fragment the related tribes into many different groupings, especially if no threat was present and clear to all. Because of this, a large amount of remarkably strong and internally cohesive identities would be created, even if fragmented politically over the wider area. It is here where we will focus in on the region which roughly corresponds to the modern region of Zlatibor in western Serbia, on the borders of Bosnia and Montenegro. This was but one of several of these mountainous regions which were inhabited by related groups of Slavs, many of whom likely had Serbian aristocratic roots. By the early 9th century, Bulgar expansion had begun to take place north, east, and south of these highlands, incorporating and replacing leaderships of the Timuk Slavs in Sirmium, as well as several Macedonian Slavs near Lake Ohrid. This mass expansion would provide enough of a threat to jumpstart the creation of a higher identity for the fragments of the region. As mentioned in this series' introduction, the creation of a higher union identity could be a very difficult thing. It required a mix of both unseen cultural forces, which generated similarities in identity among local elites, and conscious unification and militaristic forces, which could provide a shared framework for these elites to be integrated into. Even if successful, these identities remained vague parent identities, only conditionally taken into account by the populations which shared them, who were far more invested in their local communities. At the time, here as in other areas of Central Europe, the local community was the basis of organization. Here, the local population centers were even more coherent through the natural funneling of the land into clear nodes, which were known as župas. A župa normally consisted of a single river valley population, who shared a common need for access to surrounding hunting grounds, the valley river for water and milling, and mountain pastures for grazing. The few clans which made up the community would unite under a župan, who was a chieftain of good reputation who was trusted to oversee protection. What separated this tribal orientation from the other forms of local organization was its lack of specialization. The župan was trusted with a series of duties and responsibilities, which were neither enumerated nor absolute. They were simply what the clans expected of them at that moment in time, whatever that may be. Normally, this simple organization was all that was necessary to maintain their autonomy and cohesion. However, at times of external threat, it could become necessary for several Zhupas to unite in a temporary union based on geographic concerns, led by a parent elite known as a Nyez, who would attempt to protect the interests and common framework of the constituting Zhupans. This is what happened in response to the Bulgar threat, as those Zhupas in Zlatibor, which were most threatened by the Bulgar frontier, thought to be only a few valleys away near the old Byzantine fortification of Raz, would begin the process of unification in response. It is because of this unique situation, which we can assume the Serbian identity was mostly geographical and terrain-based. It represented the cultural aspects of those groups of isolated Slavic communities, which were simultaneously influenced by Latin Dalmatian Croatia, the continental imperialism of Bulgaria, and the universal maritime imperialism of Byzantium, though in stubborn opposition to all three. As the Serbian aristocracy likely remained a parallel similarity in identity which could express this unique situation, this geographic identity would become known as Serbian, and a Serbian union would form. The first Nyez of great prominence would be Vlastimir, based out of Zlatibor. Vlastimir would successfully unite many Zhupans against the Bulgarian threat, likely through a mix of tribal diplomacy, military subjugation, and outside recognition. Soon, a core of land stretching from modern western Serbia into Bosnia would emerge, with surrounding influenced lands along the coast and further north along the Dinarics. The Bulgars would put this new union to the test in 839, when they launched an invasion of these forested lands to coincide with their expansion towards Macedonia. The Byzantines, seeing the Serbs as useful allies against the growing Bulgarian threat, would support the centralization process through gifts of gold, prestige, and influence, which further served to help unify the various Zhupas under Vlastimir and against the Bulgars. Thanks to this, a long war of resistance would follow, and eventually, Vlastimir would successfully eject the Bulgars from the Serbian highlands by 850, reversing the trend of Slavic absorption which had taken place around them. Vlastimir would also formalize Serbian influence within modern Montenegro and northern Albania, through marriage ties with consolidated Slavic powers there, which included Trebinje, Konavli, and the future lands of Dukloja and Zaklumija. These powers would remain peripheral to the Serbian core, however, and act with changing loyalties to either the Serbs, Byzantines, or Bulgarians over the next century. Around this time, though, Vlastimir would die, leaving Serbia divided between his three sons, as was common with many Slavic chiefdoms. The prominence of Vlastimir in the creation and defense of Serbia would lead to his line being known as the Sons of Vlastimir, or the Vlastimirovich dynasty. They would claim descent all the way from the unknown leader of the Serbs, who led his people from Sorbia way back in the 7th century, although the accuracy of this is unknown. Only a few years after Vlastimir's death, though, around 853, the Bulgars, under their new Khan Boris I, would return to launch another major invasion of the Serbian principality, with a major army led by Boris's son, Vladimir. This force, too, would be defeated by the Serbian defensive forces, likely through an ambush somewhere within the complicated network of mountainous lands. This Bulgar defeat was quite total, as Vladimir himself and a dozen leading Bulgar aristocrats were captured. However, these captives would be utilized by both the Serbs and Boris to come to an agreeable arrangement, as in return for the captives and a mutual exchange of many symbolic gifts along the frontier, hostilities between the Serbs and Bulgarians would end, and a friendship would be established for the remainder of the 9th century, an event seen as a major success by both parties. Internally, however, without the Bulgarian threat, the rule of the three brothers would come to an end, as the brother Mutamir would seize power for himself and send his other two brothers into exile in Bulgaria. Mutamir would then live out the remainder of his reign in relative peace until the 890s, when he would die and his son would then be overthrown by the son of one of Mutamir's brothers. This man would be named Peter, and he had been gathering strength in Croatia for precisely this moment. Peter would then rule over the consequential next couple of decades, which we will get to soon. Chapter 3: The Christianization of Serbia and Bulgaria. For now, though, it is important to note Peter's name, one which was clearly Christian in origin. This symbolizes that the Serbian elite had likely largely converted to Christianity by this point in time, although the details of such a process largely elude us. We know that those Slavic principalities in the Serbian orbit would participate in Latin councils along with the Croatians in the early 10th century, implying that the Latins may have played a large role in their earlier conversions. They would likely be placed under the Archbishopric of Sirmium, which was created under St. Methodius as part of the events of the Moravian conversion in the 860s and 870s. The Archbishopric of Sirmium was a Latin-run jurisdiction, which further supports this view. However, Byzantine influence within Serbia was well known and documented, as we've already seen in the story, and so the rule of Constantinople cannot be ignored. The Christianization process of Serbia would help to support their centralized administration and maintain their new larger identity as part of the wider European Christian network. At this time, the Church remained Catholic and universal, though events in Bulgaria will begin to expose some cracks in this regard. The aforementioned new Bulgar Khan in the 850s was known as Boris I, and he will be responsible for an overhaul of the state's administration and its place among the rulers of Europe, largely through his skillful diplomacy and sweeping Christianization efforts. Boris's reign would begin with several military failures, including the disastrous invasion of Serbia, in which his son and many leading nobles were captured. He would also aim to ally with the Moravians against the French, and face setbacks in Pannonia as well. Despite all of this, his realm would lose little, and gain diplomatic alliances and a stronger frontier presence. This would be the strength of Boris. He would always prove to be adaptable to the realm's many challenges, and able to maintain focus on the long-term strengthening of culture and administration. The main tests of Boris's strength would come with the long process of Bulgarian conversion to Christianity. Christianity, as a moral force, had long been spreading within Bulgarian society and even among its elites. With much of the centralized strength coming from the Black Sea trade and cooperation with the Greeks, it was only a matter of time before the source of the shining Byzantine culture would work its way in as a base of the Bulgarian one, too. The wars of the 9th century would also see many transitions of entire populations from one region to another, both by the Byzantines from their Christian interior to more pagan exteriors, and by Bulgarians moving seized Christian populations and their new territories to be located further inland. In both cases, the Christian influences would be better able to reach the inner European interior. This would multiply when the Latin Church also began to be involved with events in Carpathia, through overtaking the Methodian mission to Great Moravia, which we discussed last time. An archbishopric in Sirmium and temporary toleration of evangelizing in the Slavic vernacular would allow for much greater reach along the Danube. By 863, Boris himself would decide to convert. It is known that his sister was a Christian, and may likely have played a significant role in the Khan's decision. Some of his trusted officials were also known Christians. In any case, his conversion seemed to be a genuine and personally held belief, as he would demonstrate through his later policies and his decision to retire to a monastery before he passed. This conversion, though, would enter Boris in with the unfolding drama taking place between the two sees of the Universal Church. As Bulgaria was much closer to the eminence of Constantinople, asking for admission and administrators from their patriarch would surely lead to an unwelcome rush of Byzantine influence, which, due to the nature of their intertwined political and religious control in the person of the emperor, would surely overtake the growing Bulgarian state from the inside. So, much like the Moravians, who had reached out to the Byzantines due to their distance and inability to directly interfere, the Bulgarians would reach out to the Latins, due to their own distance and inability to directly interfere. However, Byzantium would not allow such a thing to happen so easily, and upon hearing of this plan, would launch an invasion of the newly Christianized Bulgaria, which Boris had not expected at all. He would be forced to negotiate and concede to Constantinople, with his armies many days away in Moravia. The only concession would be for the Bulgarian church to fall under jurisdiction of the Patriarch of Constantinople, who would immediately send a Greek clergyman to bring the Bulgarians into the fold. Boris himself would be baptized in 864, and missionaries from all corners would be invited to convert the populace. This rapid change would lead to a revolt from the military aristocracy, who are known as the Boyars, against this new Christian administration. The cause for this outburst likely sprang from the accompanying political changes that came with the conversion from a pagan administration to a Christian one. As Christian rulers, Boris and his peers were expected to rule as a duty to God himself, transfiguring the resources at their disposal to uphold stability, morality, and honor, so as to help their subjects in their salvation. This role differed greatly from that of prior pagan imperium, which placed all prominent Boyar clans as equals in the realm of administration, or more properly called, extraction from their contributing populations. They expected only to unite around the Khan for times of war, but this kind of hierarchy would be incompatible with the new structure being imported, one which was largely Byzantine and stressed autocracy and coherent legal institutions. So, the Boyars would revolt in the name of restoring paganism and their old legal privileges. The Boyars, though, would be crushed, with the only source on the whole upheaval being that it was resolved through a miracle by Boris. 52 leading noble families would be executed for their treason, allowing Boris to replace their insolent positions with new and presumably more loyal and Christian men. By this point, the new, properly Bulgarian state can be seen as having a centralized, militaristic, and imperial core, with appointed noblemen and a heavy cavalry standing retinue on the lower Danube. The provinces of the wider empire, however, can still be seen as under control of those greater boyars, who had been trusted to build their own autonomous power bases, and would be called upon only as needed from the center. But with the chaos of initial conversion over, we resume the story of the church feuds. As part of the administrative overhaul, Boris would begin a correspondence with the Patriarch of Constantinople, asking him of proper church practices and legal structures to better build the new Bulgarian society. The Patriarch would answer in a somewhat flowery way, speaking more on duties, theology, and church history than on the courses of action or aid for the young and vulnerable Christian state. As a result, Boris would send a similar request to the Pope in Rome, hoping to receive more in the way of practical advice and support of genuine resources. The Latins saw this as their perfect way to re-enter the theater, and so responded strongly, sending a bishop along with several missionaries and papal representatives to establish a formal church system with direct papal orders. Once in Bulgaria, they would overtake the Greek missionaries and invite a flood of Frankish missionaries and clerics to migrate down along the Danube. Soon, Bulgaria would have its own bishopric, with an archbishopric promised to be in the works by the Pope. It was also here where, in addition to the more obvious grievances caused by the displacement of the Greek clergymen, there also arose disputes on doctrine between the Western and Eastern churches. The many years of isolation had meant that practices had been allowed to drift, and with increasingly little regular contact between the two, the various reforms and administrative overhauls taking place in both hemispheres had never really cross-checked with each other to ensure continuing uniformity. Now that both came face-to-face and were specifically posed by Boris with questions of proper church practice, the differences would come to light. This included the practice of priestly marriage, which the Latins condemned, and the practices of eating dairy during Lent, and the addition of the filioque to the central Nicene Creed, which the Greeks condemned. In Constantinople, a council would be held which first declared these Western practices to be condemned, and later excommunicated the Pope himself for upholding them. The Pope would die before the full implications of this were realized, but the next Pope would not easily forget these initial actions of the East, and became very suspicious both of Byzantium and Bulgaria, who, despite being under papal influence, had received continuous information from Constantinople that the papal practices would prevent Boris's salvation, which may have caused a rift to appear. So, when Boris asked for the seat of archbishopric to be granted to the papal bishop who was initially sent over, the Pope would see it as an illegal investiture, both denying the request and recalling the original bishop. All of this chaos between East and West would provoke a series of demands back and forth between them, which led to a climactic council in 869. At it, Boris would sneakily send a delegation to ask just whose authority his church was under, and the council, which was being held in the East, naturally would have more people who decided that Constantinople was the proper net for the Bulgars to be under. This time, however, the Greeks were willing to grant much autonomy to the Bulgarians, anything just to stick it to the Latins. This would, again, infuriate the West, and in 877 another climactic papal delegation would demand Bulgarian re-entry to papal overlordship, among other requests. By this point, Greek clergy had already been reallowed to enter, and Boris had been enjoying the new church autonomy which was conceded from Constantinople. It was clear that even if jurisdiction was handed back to Rome, Boris would simply continue to oversee his own church regardless. So, the Byzantines folded, handing over Bulgarian administration yet again to Rome. Boris, by this point though, was in a strong enough position that he could finally break free from both sides. The Bulgarian church, after all of this, would be under the jurisdiction of none but the Bulgarian ruler, which seemed a good enough compromise for all sides involved. For Inner Europe, the independence of the Bulgarian church would be a momentous occasion. This is mostly for the reason that it would coincide with the expulsion of Methodius's disciples from Moravia. A large amount of missionaries and clerics, who had built their lives around Slavic evangelization, would arrive to Bulgaria and be allowed positions of prominence within the new church administration. Bulgarian independence would allow them to continue their work on translation of liturgical documents and writings of the Church Fathers, and begin to build a truly Slavic literary tradition. Church Slavonic would become one of the four holy languages of the world yet again, next to Hebrew, Greek, and Latin, and future Slavic rulers would find it much easier to integrate into the wider Christian world with this precedent in place. It is also here that Glagolitic would develop into a new alphabet known as Cyrillic, after Methodius's brother, St. Cyril. This would continue to be used throughout the inner European Slavic world, especially in those future Orthodox cultures. Boris would establish a separate administrative center in Macedonia, which almost purely taught an early church Slavonic liturgy, greatly helping to enhance the Bulgarian identity as a Christian one, and one which could unite all the peoples of the interior, those forgotten by both Rome and Constantinople. The final test for this Christianization would come with Boris's abdication to his son Vladimir in 889, who we had previously met when he was captured by the Serbians back in the 850s. Vladimir, however, would become dominated by the periphery elites of the empire, whose old boyars, many of whom had evaded these developments and remained pagan. He would attempt to re-establish the old ways once his father was out of the picture, and began a brutal campaign of Christian suppression. During these times, several churches which Boris had spent his reign spreading across the land would be razed, and the leading archbishopric would be martyred for the young church. Vladimir's mistake, though, was in not ensuring that his father was all the way out of the picture. Boris had only abdicated to a monastery. Upon recovering from an illness, he would come out of retirement to put his son in his place, blinding and exiling him. Following this, he would convene a council at Preslav, which was a predominantly Slavic town, away from the still largely pagan Bulgar influence Pliska. Here, he would proclaim his second son Simeon as the rightful Christian ruler, name Christianity as the religion of the state, and Old Church Slavonic as the language both of administration and liturgy. These three items could effectively sum up Boris and the legacy he hoped to leave behind, and all three would have major implications for future inner European society and culture. Chapter 4, The First Bulgarian Empire. The settlements at the Council of Preslav outlined quite clearly a way for the Bulgarian identity to solidify as a separate, more permanently independent society. Boris's successor, Simeon, though, would take a creative approach to things. As we covered earlier, a good way to think of Bulgarian identity during these times was as the inland, rural, land-based, aristocratic side of the greater universal Byzantine identity, which was actively generated through Constantinople. Simeon, though, having been trained for a life in the church before his selection as successor, was raised in Constantinople. In Constantinople, he would learn to speak and respect Greek, and then to take to heart both the Byzantine ideology and their way of running things. For him, rather than two opposing identities in the same sphere, why not make that sphere one whole identity, a Romano-Bulgarian one? However, rather than submit to Constantinople and have them be the senior partner of this reunion, he intended to show that the Bulgarians had emerged as its rightful and true leaders. An early war beginning in 894 over commerce showed that the Bulgarians had the military acumen to back their new status among the great rulers of Europe. The Bulgarians would defeat the Byzantines multiple times, before being invaded from the steppe by the Magyars. The pagan Magyars, as it turned out, had been invited to invade by none other than the Christian Byzantines, a fact which enraged the Christian Simeon. The Bulgarians would deal with this invasion by sending their own envoys to the Pechenegs, inviting them to start back up the steppe treadmill by counter-invading Magyar lands. The Pechenegs would accept and force the Magyars to retreat. Even more, their invasion would be so devastating that the Magyars would be forced away from the Dniester region to migrate over the Carpathians, where they would begin their dramatic conquest of Moravia and the Pannonian Basin, which ended last week's episode. Following this Bulgarian victory, they capped off the war with yet another stunning defeat of Byzantine forces, winning multiple commercial concessions and perpetual payments of humiliating tribute, both of which would further support their central force of elite heavy cavalry, and ensured 20 years of peace to further solidify their power. It is this very war, 20 years later though, which would prove to be the decisive one for the wider region. In 913, a new administration in Constantinople would cancel their regular payments of tribute to Bulgaria. This clearly broke the treaty, and so Simeon would march to war once again. This time, though, he felt able to put his wider plans into motion. As Christian and wider European doctrine taught, and as all learned people believed at the time, especially within Constantinople, the natural order on earth was for there to be one Christian universal empire, which was known as the Roman Empire. The current administration in Constantinople had proven themselves unworthy of this crown, and incapable of protecting and morally guiding the Christians of the world, and so they had to be unseated. Simeon would launch an invasion straight towards Constantinople itself, where he would be crowned emperor outside of its gates by the Patriarch of Constantinople himself. This crowning would actually be a concession by the Greeks to end the siege, though of course the current emperor would not yield his position. With this siege halted, the war would continue elsewhere. The Bulgarians would have a free hand in Thrace, ravaging the land and conquering temporarily Adrianople. Later, in 917, they would utterly crush a Byzantine naval invasion in Anchialos, fully massacring some of the best of the Byzantine professional army, due to a successful cavalry-led ambush on the disorganized landing forces. With Constantinople as impregnable as ever, though, the war would seem to be quite a long one to both sides. For coherence and permanence sake, it appears that Simeon would change his imperial title from Emperor of the Romans to Emperor of the Bulgarians and the Romans, thus aligning more coherently with the building Bulgarian identity. Chapter 5, The Fall of Vlastimirovich Serbia. Around 917, the war would shift to the west, where we will finally return to the subject of this episode's trial and error, the Serbian Principality, led by Peter Vlastimirovich. The Serbs had drifted into the Bulgarian orbit with the establishment of their independent church and the influence of Church Slavonic on the wider culture of the region. After the War of 894-897, which the Bulgarians had fought against the Byzantines, they had also proven themselves to be the greatest land power in the region. Peter agreed to place Serbia under Bulgarian protection, in exchange for de facto independence and lack of involvement in Serbian succession crises, which had plagued them for the decades prior. This state of affairs as a Bulgarian tributary existed for about 20 years, as the Serbs worked on expanding their mountainous union through incorporating Slavic tribes to the west. This would include a tribe near the source of the Bosna River, whose mountains and upcoming political turmoil would allow it to begin creating an identity of its own as the Bosnians. There were also several of the groups to the west, along the rugged Adriatic coast in modern Albania, Montenegro, Croatia, and Bosnia. All of these groups had based their identity similarly around the mountainous topography of the land. An example of this would be the small principality of Zaklumia, which was named after the mountain of Hum, which rose on its horizon. As mentioned previously, these small mountainous identities could form extremely strong and internally cohesive groupings over a small area, and this is what took place here, as the Serbs would not be able to fully subjugate the coastline. In 913, when the next war between the great powers of Bulgaria and Byzantium broke out, the Byzantines would send an offer to Serbia of increased support and independence from Bulgaria, in exchange for supporting the Byzantine war effort. The Serbians, whose purpose rested on retaining the autonomy of the rugged southern Dinarids, would accept this offer, allowing Peter to attempt a more complete consolidation of power. However, the Slavic Adriatic Principality of Zaklumia, led by a prince known as Michael, would conversely feel threatened by the Serbs, an ally with the Bulgarians. The Bulgarians would be made aware by Michael of the Serbian revolt from their orbit, and send a response in 917. This invasion would be a powerful one, and managed to unseat Peter for one of his cousins who had been in exile in Bulgaria, a man known as Pavel. The Byzantines, though, would not allow their pawn to be taken so easily, and so would send their own Vlastimirovich cousin to overthrow Pavel. However, this Vlastimirovich would be captured by the Bulgarians, and also forced to declare loyalty. To think that this would end the succession crisis in Serbia would be a mistake, though, as Byzantium once again would flex its soft power by inspiring the usurper Pavel to also join in the war against their sponsors in Bulgaria. However, Michael of Zaklumia would once again prove his loyalty to Bulgaria and report Pavel's treachery, at which point the Bulgarians would overthrow him too, to place the Vlastimirovich that they had intercepted only a short time before in power. Somewhat predictably, though, this too would fail. The Byzantines would once again court the new Serbian Vlastimirovich Nies with their promises of independence. And so Slavic tribes near Serbia would once more be rallied against the Bulgarians. Simeon would send an army to deal with the issue, though unlike previous attempts, this expedition would fail. The rogue Vlastimirovich would slaughter the invading Bulgarian army and send the heads of their generals back to Constantinople. Seeing this, the Bulgarians would resolve to end the war in the West once and for all. Simeon parleyed with the Byzantines enough to ensure they would not make any big plays, and once the south was secured for a moment, he sent a large Bulgarian army to march against the Serbs. To lessen resistance, this army too would be accompanied by yet another Vlastimirovich, who had been held in Bulgarian captivity for several years, a man known as Chashlov. Ostensibly, the purpose of the mission was to replace the Serbian leader once again, and to replace him with Chashlov. But in reality, Simeon was hoping for a more permanent solution. In 924, the Bulgarian army would overwhelm the disorganized Serbian response and begin a brutal campaign of suppression. Countless strategic villages would be put to the flame, so much so that from the sources, it is indicated that the large exodus of Serbs would take place in the surrounding groupings, including Croatia and the previous Adriatic principalities. After Serb resistance had been neutralized, a Bulgarian invitation to all Serbian župans was sent, inviting them to pay homage to Chashlov as their new leader. However, when the defeated župans arrived, they were all treacherously arrested and sent back to Bulgaria to be imprisoned. Among them was Chashlov himself, having been brought out as a simple prop to ensnare the Serbian aristocracy. Following this, the Serbian principality was wiped off the map and absorbed into the now imperial Bulgaria. Simeon would follow this victory in the west with a further campaign through Bosnia and into the lands of the now Kingdom of Croatia. Croatia, as we saw last series, was a powerful and independent force in the region, aligned quite closely with Byzantium so as to leverage themselves against the Franks and Magyars. With this posture, Bulgaria considered Croatia under the great King Tomislav a threat, and clearly he really wanted the West to be finalized in its totality, so that he could focus on his true goal, Constantinople, and the glory of Rome. So, this expedition would take off through Bosnia, only to suffer a disastrous defeat in the mountains in 927. The Croatians, only a few years from their major defeat of the invading Magyars, had likely laid an ambush in terrain which had disadvantaged the primary Bulgarian strength, which was their heavy cavalry, led by the greater and lesser boyars. This defeat would force Simeon to cut his losses in the west, and focus on the south regardless. He would begin to mount a campaign against Constantinople, his true goal, but he would die before all preparations had been made. And it is there where we will leave the story of the First Bulgarian Empire for now. As an epilogue, the mountains of Zlatibor would not forget the Serbian identity which had been created there. Shortly after Simeon's death, surviving elites of the hills would throw off Bulgarian direct rule in the chaos of succession, becoming independent from the Bulgarians sometime in the late 920s. Chashlev, the betrayed Vlastimidovich prince, would escape from Bulgarian captivity around the same time, or perhaps later in 931, and return to Serbia, where he would lead the new principality. With this, several of the Serbian exiles in Croatia and scattered throughout the Dinaric Hills would return, and begin to repopulate the devastated countryside. Despite this resurgence, though, the Serbian principality had lost its power to retain independence from a position of strength. Both Byzantium and Bulgaria were at the height of their power, and had claimed universal authority, with Serbia at a strategic crossroads for either. Still, so long as they were distracted with each other, the Serbs could attempt to reconsolidate their authority by unifying the Župans of the mountains towards the common defense of their autonomy. Unable to take on this project by themselves, though, they would submit to greater Byzantine authority, unlike the partnership of before. This authority would allow Chashlav to expand into the scattered tribes of the Bosnian mountains, and to hold greater influence over the Adriatic Slavs, who in time would take on the Serbian identity into their own loose hierarchy of identities, which characterized medieval politics. It would also more firmly settle the divide over Christianization of the land in favor of the Greeks and Bulgarians, rather than the Roman Latins. Clergymen would during this time more fully integrate the land into the hierarchy of Constantinople, and begin to cement their practices and traditions. However, to bring this final trial-and-error story to a tragic close, Serbian identity was better suited at this point as a cultural aspect of the peoples of the mountains, rather than as an independent entity. In the 950s, the invading Magyars would pivot their attention to the south and begin to launch raids into the Serbian forest. The Serbs would successfully fend off a major attack, before facing a larger retaliatory force in 960. In this battle, Chashlav himself would fall against the Magyar horsemen. With his death was the finality of the Vlastimidovich line, and Serbia as a political union would dissolve, its hills destined to become the frontier of the ebbing and flowing Byzantine and Bulgarian empires over the next century. And that sad note is where we will leave today's episode. To set up the future chapter of the Serbian independent story, the Adriatic principalities, now coupled with the apparent Serbian identity, would eventually take on the mantle of independent Slavic power within the rough lands of the southern Dinarics. Although the union had dissolved, the process of cultural formation would prove to be a successful one in this case. The church authorities which had been introduced during Vlastimidovich's oversight would work to formalize localities under a Serbian umbrella, and Church Slavonic would allow for further cultural development among the remaining Župans. Dukulja, in particular, would expand to claim much of modern Montenegro, and it is with them that we will eventually return to cover the rise of the next Serbian dynasty. though the world of inner Europe will look quite different by then. Thank you very much for listening to Between the Seas. As an announcement, I'm getting married, and also moving, along with a few other joyful life changes. For the show, this means it will be a few months before we return with our sixth series, which will cover the largely inner European-led second time of invasions for Germany, what we will call the Second Dark Age. In it, we will finally dedicate quality time to one of the dominating forces of 10th century inner Europe, a people who have had huge impacts in both our previous episodes, the Magyar, along with the other rapidly growing powers of the Riverlands, the Rus and the Baltic Curonians. So, with that said, we will return to the show in June. I hope this over hour-long episode may be a nice gift for now. Feel free to leave a comment on the show through emailing the link in the description. And I hope that you, too, may experience the beauty of the mountains.